David Mikix is a professor of English at the University of Houston and the author of Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. This is David Mikix. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. Okay, I'm here with David Mikix. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you, Duncan. This is wonderful. Yes.
So I had had heard of your biography of Stanley Kubrick, and it's called Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. And I was interested because you're a professor of English, correct? So how did you arrive at writing a book about a filmmaker?
Well, it was a long journey, and the journey really started when I was about 12 years old. That's when I saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, for the first time. It was a couple years after it had been released. The movie came out in 68, so I saw it maybe 2 or 3 years after that, 3 years. And it just knocked me out. I had no idea that movies could do that to you. It just seemed absolutely otherworldly, spectacular, sublime in every possible way. And I still have that feeling about it. So I was a Kubrick fan for a long time. And then in college, I also did a lot of film studies. I went to NYU and, I ravenously saw every new movie and every old movie as well. So, that was back in the day, but I have returned to teaching film a little bit. I do it from time to time, and the last couple of years I've done it steadily. So, this is half of me now, or a third at least.
Yeah. That must have been, you said you saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, when you were 12, and this is back in, you said a couple years after it came out. So what was that, like 70, 71?
73, yeah, actually.
Oh, 73, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That, even today, the special effects for that movie are still, like, really well done. And I can't imagine back in the 70s what that must have looked like.
Mm-hmm. It's something quite remarkable. There were over 200 process shots. This is what they're called in the movie. That's when, a separate background and often several different backgrounds have to be matted into a particular shot. So in other words, there's a model of the spaceship in space, and then you have the stars behind it. You know, you have an astronaut floating, etc. And the extraordinary thing about the movie is that all of this looks perfect now, so many years later, done, as you say, in 68. And, it's a remarkable technical achievement. And there were enormous, truly enormous obstacles to it. If you only look at the first part of the movie, The Dawn of Man, with the killer apes, the man apes, designing those suits, getting the right kind of gestures, how do you impersonate sort of hybrid of man and ape, or missing link. So Kubrick hired a mime named Dan Richter, who spent months at the zoo in London studying the behavior of apes. And, he tried this, he tried that. It was a long process of trial and error. And similarly with the costumes, how do you get masks that will allow a full range of expression? So, that's just the first 20 minutes or less of the movie, but all through it, there were similar challenges.
Well, you know what's interesting about that, though, is that you were saying you took some film classes in college, and on that basis, in some ways, you had a more formal film school education than Kubrick did, who was making these incredibly elaborate, renowned special effects back in the 60s. And this was a guy, I kind of want to go into his early biography. He struck me as almost a guy who, if he didn't fall into filmmaking, he wouldn't have become renowned for something else. He was almost kind of like not a vagabond, but he was not, he did not seem like a George Lucas who went to USC film school and was pumping out student films and really trying to make it into Hollywood. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Kubrick was, certainly he was regarded by his father as a problem child. And from the very beginning, first and second grade, he stayed home about 60% of the time. and his mother allowed this. This is a phenomenon known as school refusal, where a small child just will not go to school. And so, yes, well, don't spread it around, because right. we don't want this to happen too much. But Kubrick's mother, Gert, was absolutely convinced that, you know, he was extraordinary and that, you know, she nurtured him in this. And when he set his mind to something, you know, he was a fanatical chess player. And for a while, when he couldn't find jobs in movies in the 50s, he would earn his living playing chess in Washington Square Park in New York. So chess, and then photography. His first job was as a still photographer out of high school for Look magazine. These were things that he taught himself, really, especially photography. And he focused on them with a kind of maniacal intent. I'm reminded of a line by Michael Herr, who was the screenwriter of Full Metal Jacket and a friend of Kubrick's, and also wrote one of the great books about the Vietnam War, Dispatches. So Michael Herr said, "You would have to be Herman Melville to transmit the full force of Stanley's will." That, you know, he just had this implacable sense, you know, that, you know, he was going to do it. And in terms of his technical knowledge of cinema, it's true that, as, and this is very unusual, in those days there were no film schools. By the way, I should have said, I took a lot of film studies. I didn't actually make films in college.
Sure, okay.
But, you know, Kubrick, the normal route for a filmmaker was to attach yourself to a studio. And, you know, you watch people doing it, and then, you know, you work your way up to being a director. Kubrick did not do that. He taught himself out of books how to make a movie. You know, he raised the money from an uncle to make his first short. And so, you know, he figured out how to do it by himself. And it's extraordinary the way that the depth of his knowledge of photography and of every other aspect of movie making, he had a sort of uncanny grasp of technical details. Everybody testifies to that. So you know, partly it has to do with his with his capacity for focus, the way he really did devote himself to filmmaking, that you know, he had such mastery of it. Jeffrey Unsworth, who was director of photography on several of his movies, said, "This man knows more about photography than anyone who ever lived." And Unsworth had been a top British director of photography for a couple decades when he said that. So so it was quite something.
That's it. You said he raised money from his uncle. How did he go from being basically like an independent filmmaker to a guy who, like, his movies, he sat on them a long time. Mm-hmm. How did he get to that point where he could do what he wanted in the time he wanted to do it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's the movies that Kubrick made in the 50s were not terribly successful. The first movie, which he later disowned, and it really is a rather amateurish film, was called Fear and Desire, 1953, it came out. And then there were two more, much more mature movies, Killer's Kiss and The Killing, and then also Paths of Glory, which starred Kirk Douglas. So that Paths of Glory was a also not terribly successful. It was a rather pessimistic war film. It was banned in France because it was about a scandal in the French army in World War I. So really, it was not until Kubrick was called in by Kirk Douglas to be the director of Spartacus, which came out in 1960. It's not until that point that Kubrick really hit it big. Now, in later years, he was able to take his time with projects. And to, you know, he was famous for demanding take after take. He had a small cruise. The movies were not very expensive, with the exception of 2001. But he was able to take his time. It's partly because the movies were not, in the end, very expensive. A Clockwork Orange, for example, cost $2 million. Very, very cheap movie. But he had the trust of the studio executives, particularly in his final period where he worked with Warner Brothers. people like John Calley and Terry Semel, the Warner Brothers producers, you know, they knew they had an artistic genius on their hands, and they knew that a Kubrick movie, you know, would last, and they let him do it the way he wanted. There's another piece of this too, which is that 2001 was one of the top 10 moneymakers for MGM. And this was after, at the initial screening, hordes of MGM executives walked out. They convinced that this was a mammoth turkey. No one would ever see this.
What?
It's so boring. Yes, it's hard to imagine that. And you know, by the next day, when it in the real opening, crowds were lining up to see it. They were all under 30, however, and the studio executives were much older. So they really had no sense of what would appeal. It was a revolutionary movie. I mean, it was the first Hollywood movie that really forced the audience to actively speculate, to wonder, what does this all mean? What are we to make of it? And it is very slow moving. You know, it's like a slow moving dance, solemn and serene. And so, yeah, it is not your usual Hollywood movie, but it was an enormous hit, and it continued to be. It was re-released over and over in the 70s.
Okay, so that makes a little bit more sense, that he did have some financial successes, at least enough that he could afford to sort of lay back and take some time, which is...
Yeah, larger cultural phenomenon, which is the rise of art house movies. You know, the real background is the success of television at invading American households. And so, you know, with the competition of television, movies become overall less profitable and also more diverse. So, you know, you see more movies that are influenced by European art house classics, for example. And, you know, so there's more experimentation that's allowed in the post-war period.
Was he, this is kind of his reputation, but was he really a dictator on set?
Well, yes and no. Mostly no is the answer. Although one of his cherished collaborators, Ken Adam, who worked on Dr. Strangelove, he designed one of the greatest sets in movie history, the War Room in Dr. Strangelove. That was Ken Adam. And he also worked for a while on Barry Lyndon. So Ken Adam said, we were expected to obey his orders like Rommel's Africa Corps. And, you know, so that's a picture of Kubrick as being, you know, sort of commanding general. And in fact, he did want to make a movie about Napoleon. Kubrick was fascinated by Napoleon. So I think he did see himself as a sort of Napoleonic figure who had to be in control of every aspect of the movie. And, you know, that's part of his personality. But there's another part too, which is that he really thrived on collaboration, not just in the early stages with screenwriters like Michael Hare or Diane Johnson, with whom he wrote The Shining. You know, that was, there's a lot of to and fro, a lot of dialogue between him and his screenwriters about the shaping of the movie, but also during the making of the movie itself. I talked for quite a while with Vincent D'Onofrio, who was Private Pyle in Full Metal Jacket. And he said, well, you know, Kubrick would call Matthew Modine and me into the trailer. They were both in their 20s, both in their early 20s at the time. And Kubrick would say, you know, what do you think we should do in this scene? You know, they would invent bits of dialogue. Some of the most famous scenes in Kubrick's movies were invented by his actors, like the lip reading scene in 2001. It was Gary Lockwood, who plays one of the astronauts, who came up with that. So Kubrick was game. He really knew that making movies is a partnership, and he was not a dictator on the set. But he didn't tolerate screw ups, and you know, things had to be just right. I forget now who said, I think it was Terry Southern, another collaborator, who said, Stanley let nothing so much as a trouser pleat go unsupervised. So, you know, he had such a tremendous eye for detail. But the best line, and the one I'll finish this comment with, is he once said, Kubrick accepted the D.W. Griffith Award for direction. And he said, making movies is kind of like writing War and Peace in a bumper car.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like you're trying to do this monumental thing, and you have to bounce off everybody else. So he enjoyed that bouncing, even as, you know, it's sort of the constant interruption of every possible accident. You know, you arrive at the studio in the morning, and there are dozens of people who need an answer for you. Who need an answer from you about this, about that. So he was really able. He was very practically minded, and he was able to do all sorts of workarounds, and was able to handle these various details very effectively.
Well, it's interesting as you're saying that. I'm just thinking of how, I'm curious to ask you this, particularly because you are a professor of English, and as like the dominant sort of form of art in our culture has probably become. It's more centered around like movies and TV than it was literature back in the 1800s. And it mm-hmm. requires a different kind of artist, because if you're a writer, you really are, you basically are a dictator on the page. You're mm-hmm. total king of that universe. But like someone like Kubrick, you couldn't have a dictator of a director, because you're mm-hmm. working with real people. So, I mean, that mm-hmm. that does make sense. It kind of defies that myth that's been built around him. One of the things I wanted to ask you about on that same note is he adapted a number of books into movies, and something that Hitchcock said was that you could only adapt a bad book or like an okay book, but if you adapted right. a really great book, it would outshine the movie. But Kubrick adapted Lolita, which is considered a classic. How do you think those two compare, the book and the movie?
Yeah, it's a great question, Duncan. I mean, I've taught Lolita several times. I love the book. I've always liked it. It's, I think it will remain, you know, although nowadays there are various critiques of it. It's a very incendiary subject, you know. It's about a rapist, and a charming rapist at that. But Nabokov makes clear that Humbert is a monster. You know, he's an evil character in the book. That's less true in the movie. Kubrick really could not bring that out, I think, in the movie. And he could also not, he said, you know, I couldn't really bring out any eroticism in the movie such as exists in the book. So in a sense, the movie is more tame than the book, both in terms of the depth of Humbert's character, the depth of his charm, and the depth of his wickedness. Those are clear in the book. They're a lot less clear in the movie. But the movie is a wonderful achievement, I think. And, you know, Kubrick coached the young Sue Lyon, who played Lolita. And it's a fascinating performance. You know, she is this sort of bratty, insolent, teenager, and you know, she has a sort of, as I said, it's kind of like Her Majesty the Teen. You know, she has this sort of complete domination of her realm. You know, she's very disdainful of adults, especially her mother, played by Shelley Winters, memorably in the movie. And James Mason is terrific too. Nabokov enjoyed working with Kubrick, but when the movie came out, he said, you know, I discovered that Kubrick was a great director and only odds and ends of my script had been used. So, you know, basically Nabokov's script, which was more or less unfilmable, was thrown away, and Kubrick did his own thing. But Nabokov did love seeing James Mason in the title role. Peter Sellers as Quilty. This is a very different character from the one in the book, much more fleshed out. And in a way, Quilty, who's this sort of madcap, antic manipulator, a kind of shapeshifter. You know, he plays various parts in the movie. You know, that's something that's not in the book. So he adds to the book as well as changing it.
It's interesting you say that, because on the other hand, you have a writer like Stephen King, who apparently hated The Shining, which makes no sense to me at all. Do you know the story at all behind that?
Yeah, the story was that King actually wanted Kubrick to to follow his book, you know, much more faithfully. And the book, for one thing, is it's kind of a baggy monster. I mean, it's a book of great power, but it is rather messy. There's a lot of backstory. There's a lot about Jack Torrance's life in Vermont as a school teacher, about his drinking, about his family, and so it has the rhythm, or lack of rhythm, of a Stephen King book rather than of a film. And the great things that Kubrick invented, like Jack's death in the snowy labyrinth at the end of the movie, in the hedge maze. King didn't like that. That's not in the book, but it's a genius invention on the part of Kubrick. So I think that King just wanted things his own way. And in fact, he did get to produce a version of The Shining for TV, which I have not seen. And apparently it's not so great.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe it's good. I haven't seen it, but I've heard rumors that it's a lot less impressive than the film.
I can only imagine. I mean, that kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier about the dictator and writing and in film. Like, if I were Stephen King, even if the guy didn't follow what I was doing, it's a Stanley Kubrick movie. It's a classic. Like, how can you not embrace that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it seems, I don't know. I don't want to say it seems.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, it does seem a strange reaction. But, you know, people got to compare the two in the end. And, you know, audiences have always chosen Kubrick's version of The Shining over King's TV version. So, yeah.
What about, you mentioned Full Metal Jacket, and that's a movie about Vietnam War. But was Kubrick a very political guy? Did politics enter his life in any significant way?
That's a great question, Duncan, because it's a bit odd, because you would think that somebody who made a movie like Dr. Strangelove, which is about the world being annihilated by nuclear bombs, you know, the doomsday machine is set off, and so virtually all life on Earth is destroyed, except for this small group of elite generals and politicians who get to shelter underground and survive the nuclear holocaust. So seems like an awfully political subject, but what it really is a satire, and by its nature, satire goes overboard. It's extreme. And if you were to ask Kubrick, well, what political position are you taking here? You know, well, the position is he was terrified of nuclear war for a while in the early 60s while he was planning to make Dr. Strangelove. He was very seriously intent on moving his family to Australia, you know, and he would say things like, well, you know, it's like the Jews in Germany and Eastern Europe. They all said, oh, you know, this is no big deal, but the Nazis are not really going to come to anything. They won't start a war. And, you know, it's going to happen again. We have to go to Australia and escape this, you know, nuclear disaster. In the end, he didn't go, of course. So he took the threat very seriously. But when he was approached after Dr. Strangelove by various organizations asking him to make statements about the threat of nuclear war, he refused to do that. And he said, well, you know, the movie speaks for itself. I'm not going to endorse a political position. Same thing with Full Metal Jacket. And earlier on, of course, Full Metal Jacket was made long after the end of the Vietnam War, 12 years after the end of the Vietnam War. But when the war was going on in interviews, you know, an interviewer would ask him something like, well, would you like to see the US withdraw from Vietnam? And he would say, in one instance, he just said, sure. And so, you know, he wasn't going to use his movies for grandstanding, you know, as the vehicle of a political statement. So this is particularly interesting in respect to Clockwork Orange, I think, because Clockwork Orange also has, you know, it has a very pointed program. It has a very pointed content in the sense that it's a critique of behaviorism, of the idea of controlling human beings through psychological programming, you know, so that Malcolm McDowell in the movie is, he's supposed to lose his malice. He's supposed to be tamed out of his evil impulses through behavioral control. And so Kubrick here was, you know, making a sort of statement about, you know, the popularity of behaviorism at that time. In the early 70s, writers like B.F. Skinner especially were saying that, you know, we can improve society if we simply, you know, let ourselves manipulate human behavior in this way. But the movie is much more than that, of course. And at the heart of the movie, I think, is the way in which we're both made very queasy, actually nauseated, repulsed, we're repulsed by Alex's criminal behavior. But we have a sort of mixture of feelings about the violence, you know, so we're drawn to it even as we're disgusted by it. So in exploring that ambivalence, Kubrick really, I think, goes far beyond any sort of narrow political critique. And that's true of all of his movies. So is Paths of Glory an anti-war movie, as the movie I mentioned from the 50s about World War I? Is Full Metal Jacket an anti-war movie, quote unquote? He never called them that. He never said, these are anti-war movies. They're movies about war. And so there's a sense in which war is the scene, is the realm in which he's giving us this movie. But the movie really is about human violence, and male violence especially, and all the ambiguity that goes along with it.
Yeah, and it seems like the kinds of movies that do try to provide strong answers or make political statements tend to be weaker movies, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he does a great job of just, like, framing a question, and mm-hmm. you can sort of puzzle over that for a long time, like at the end of 2001, A Space Odyssey. Mm-hmm.
Many of the movies at the end of Full Metal Jacket, the face-off between Joker and the Vietnamese sniper, And I won't give away what happens after that for those who haven't seen the movie.
Right.
But a lot of the endings are very pregnant with, you know, with ambivalence, and they're sort of very resonant puzzles. So, yeah, I mean, the bad example is something like, I mean, Chaplin was a great actor and great director, one of the greatest in movie history. But a couple of times he did ruin his movies by making, you know, by sort of talking directly into the camera and making a statement about world peace, most notably in The Great Dictator, which ends with a speech by Chaplin, you know, talking about universal brotherhood and peace and so on. And so it's like that is the way you don't want to go, you know, imposing a lesson on the, imposing a clear-cut lesson on the audience.
Do you come, this is kind of in some ways a hopeless question, but do you come to any conclusions of your own about what the end of 2001 is about?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a great question. I wouldn't say I've come to a conclusion, but what I do love about the ending is the way in which it seems somehow ominous and threatening, as well as promising or hopeful. And these things are melded together. It's a sort of blended shudder that you have at the end of that film. And it is a shudder, you know, there is something, you know, it causes you to tremble a little bit as the Star Child turns its eye towards the Earth. Now, in the novel that Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke wrote, they wrote a novelization of 2001 while they were making the film. The last line of the novel is something like, yeah, this is it. It's about how the Star Child doesn't know what he's going to do next. And the final line is, but he would think of something. And so that is quite ominous. I think, you know, the idea is we've journeyed in this one film from human prehistory into the future, into post-history, the post-history of the human. This is a new kind of being. And what we had at the beginning was a killer ape. Kubrick loved the work of the anthropologist Robert Ardrey, a very popular writer in the 60s. And Ardrey said, we were born not of fallen angels, but of risen apes and killer apes besides. So, you know, he was trying to emphasize the way in which violence is part of who we are as humans. Well, what about the ending? Well, you know, what will happen at the end? Have we been purged of violence or not? This is a major question and one that will never be answered. So I think the real point is the sort of premonitory eerie feeling you get at the end of that film, and you can't resolve it. That's the whole point.
Fair enough. Yeah, I know. I just wanted to see what your thoughts on that were, because you obviously have explored this pretty deeply. You had also mentioned there that he was considering moving his family to Australia, but he did move to England. What was there a particular or important reason for that?
There were a couple of reasons. In the early 60s, his wife, Christiane, he met her in the during the filming of Paths of Glory in 1956. And so they returned to LA first, of course. That's where you were when, if you were a filmmaker, you were based in LA. So they were there through the late 50s. And then after the filming of Spartacus, they moved to New York City. And Christiane didn't like New York City at all. She thought it was rough, dirty, unpleasant, especially for children. And at this point, the Kubricks had two daughters. He adopted and her older daughter. So they actually had three young daughters. So that was one factor. Another factor was it was very inexpensive to make movies in the UK. Britain had a law whereby if 80% of a movie's personnel were British, costs were cut substantially. And so there were all kinds of financial advantages. And as a result, Kubrick decided to make Lolita in Britain. He then decided to stay in that country. And I think part of it was that although he thrived on information from Hollywood, he would spend hours and hours on the phone talking to producers, actors, various friends who lived in LA. He did not want to be there. He did not want to be at the center of things. He wanted to hear about it on the phone.
Mm.
And so really England was his own domain. He was able to, control the environment much better in England, especially, in the last few decades, where he lived in a rambling house, really a kind of manor house in a place called Chidwickbury near London. It's a house that has over 200 rooms. There was ample opportunity for him to feel that he had his own separate space.
Why do you think that was important for him to be on the outside of Hollywood looking in?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it goes along with his sense of, he really needed control over his movies. There's a famous phrase he uses. He was considering a contract with Columbia Pictures in the early 60s. And he said he had a series of notes on this contract, which actually, he never signed the contract. He went somewhere else. But he said, I need complete, total, final, annihilating artistic control over the picture. And so all he would agree to was the studio could do two things. They could have say over the actors, over the main actors in the movie, and the budget of the movie, but nothing else. So he succeeded in getting this. Very few directors succeeded in having that kind of degree of control. And he was convinced, I think, that part of it was his physical separation. And also during the making of the movies, it was a funny story during film Full Metal Jacket that there was this trailer on a set of Full Metal Jacket, which, it was filmed, of course, in England. So there's a trailer, and at one point, Vincent D'Onofrio asked Kubrick, well, what's going on in that trailer? And Kubrick said, oh, those are the Warner Brothers people. We don't let them come out. He didn't want people from the studio prowling around the set, and that would be much more likely to happen in Los Angeles, of course.
Okay, yeah, that seems to fit well with his personality, I guess. what yes. His last movie, which I just watched recently, was Eyes Wide Shut. But you talk about how he was going back and forth on that for decades. And at first, when he wanted to make it, his wife didn't want him to do it because she thought it would bring up problems in their marriage. Or what was the reasoning there?
Yeah, she said, Christiane reported many years later, she said, oh, Stanley wanted to make this movie shortly after they got married, end of the 50s or early 60s, it's not clear which. And she said, oh, we're too young for this. We'll have to wait. He was obsessed with the source, the book that Eyes Wide Shut is based on. A book called Dream Story by Arthur Schnitzler, a Viennese Jewish writer from the turn of the century. And so he was very drawn to this, it's a novella, really, a short novel. And all of what it brings up about the intimacy, the jealousy within a relationship. Kubrick had two difficult marriages already, especially the second one was quite difficult. And Christiane's previous marriage had been difficult as well. And so I think there was some sense on her part that let's not jinx this one, you know, when we are so happy, you know, when we finally gotten to the place we both wanted to be. In fact, they did remain married for 40 years till the end of Kubrick's life. But yeah, it is, it's quite a movie. I can't tell you how many people have responded this way. When I was writing the book, I would, you know, say to someone, oh, you know, I'm writing a book on Kubrick. And they'd say, what was that last movie of his, you know, in a kind of puzzled or outraged tone, you know? So the movie really draws mixed responses in the sense that some people are left very cold by it, or think that it's just strange or unappealing somehow. And in fact, when I first saw it, I was relatively indifferent to it. You know, I didn't get it. And I've had that, other people have told me that too, that, you know, it took a few times, after you watch it a few times, you get drawn into it. The movie certainly has its fans, Eyes Wide Shut, and there's a kind of cult around it, as there is around Kubrick himself. So I found myself gradually drawn into the orbit of this strange last movie, which Kubrick was convinced was his best movie. He died just a couple days after he completed it, and he was very happy with it.
That's so crazy that he died almost immediately after finishing it. I mean, there are people who seem to retire, and then a year within their retirement, they die. Because it's like you're finished, you got this weight off your shoulder, and almost like your body's ready to go. But that's
it really was one of those cases. You know, Kubrick near the end was in quite bad shape. His father was a doctor, but he never saw a doctor himself. He was scared of learning about the state of his health. And towards the end, he was sleeping with an oxygen tank in his room. You know, he was very tired. He was very short of breath. And probably most alarmingly of all, he was now sleeping more. He usually slept only 4 or 5 hours a night. But toward the end, he was sleeping more. And, you know, people have said, oh, you know, towards the end of the work on the movie, it was, you know, like they would leave him off at the door of his house and he would have difficulty finding his way to the door. You know, so he was very, very tired, very worn down in the course of making that movie, but he was determined to finish it, and he did. And the first studio screening after it happened, he called Tom Cruise and they talked for 2 or 3 hours, and Kubrick was very, very pleased with the film.
And he almost didn't cast Tom Cruise, right? I mean, he had a big list that you pointed out, that Bill Murray, Woody Allen was on, which Woody Allen in that movie would have just been a total freak show. But I mean, especially thinking about it now, but how did that, why were those names under consideration?
Part of that really just has to do with a long gestation of this movie. And for a long time, he didn't know what kind of movie it was going to be. So after Woody Allen's Manhattan came out, he thought maybe I should make it in black and white, and it would have a kind of feeling like Manhattan, which was a movie that he liked. And so I think because that one, that movie, which was by Woody Allen, also starred Woody Allen. So he was thinking of him for that reason. And then he thought maybe it should be comic. Maybe it should be very overtly comic. And so he was thinking of Steve Martin or Bill Murray. There were other possibilities too. Sam Shepard at one point he thought of. But by the time he set his mind to making it, there were two other movies that he was thinking of making in the 90s. This was the longest gap between any of his movies, the one between Full Metal Jacket and Eyes Wide Shut, gap of 12 years. But he was thinking of making AI, and he worked a lot on AI. Eventually that project went to Steven Spielberg, who was his friend, and became, I think, a terrific Spielberg movie, actually my favorite Spielberg movie. And the other was The Aryan Papers, which was a story about the Holocaust, taken from a great novel called Wartime Lies by Louis Begley. So those were the other two potential projects. But he finally, in the 90s, but he finally wound up making Eyes Wide Shut instead. And he was drawn to Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. First of all, he liked Cruise very much in his previous performances. For example, Born on the 4th of July, which was a real tour de force on Cruise's part. And he liked the idea that they were a couple in real life in the movie. The shoot, yes, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing. Yeah, no, that definitely adds to it.
Yeah, and he I wouldn't say exploited, that this was an important part of the movie, the fact that they were a couple in real life, that he got to know them so well. Kidman said that, you know, Stanley knew us better than our parents did. The filming took 16 months. It was the longest continuous shoot in film history. And so, there was really a sense that there was a lot of psychodrama going on here in a very deep way during the filming.
Well, yeah, and Tom Cruise also, some of his like best performances have been like in Magnolia or Eyes Wide Shut, are kind of these almost repressed characters who sort of see flashes of his real self under there. And I wonder if he saw any of that in Tom Cruise.
Oh, yes, very much so. Yeah, I mean, Magnolia is a magnificent performance. And so that sense of, the kind of stiffness, the repressed quality of Tom Cruise, he was very drawn to that. And I think he knew that the hero of the movie had to have that kind of, slightly kind of blank slate or everyman look, somebody who was uptight, who was, who was repressed, who was restrained. And, the real glory of the movie, to my mind, are the dialogue scenes between Bill and Alice, that is Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, in which she really shows herself as a superb performer and, probably the most interesting woman in any Kubrick movie. And certainly in a way, she is the heart of the movie, even though Tom Cruise takes up more screen time.
The last question I wanted to ask you, because I know you got to go, but if, and this might be kind of an unanswerable question, but if you had to compare Kubrick's artistic reputation and legacy to anyone from the entire history of literature, where do you think he stacks up?
That's a great question. And, it's not something I've thought about before, so I'll probably stumble a bit. Okay. I would begin with, he liked very much genre. I mean, he read everything. I mean, I don't mean he read everything. Nobody reads everything. Mm-hmm. But he read, his reading was very wide ranging. So, you know, one of his favorite novels was Vanity Fair by Thackeray. And then, of course, Barry Lyndon is based on another Thackeray novel. So he admired those works. I mean, with Barry Lyndon, he was really trying to do a movie that, you know, showed you, you know, the full range of a society, you know, all of its manners, its mores, its customs. And so for, in that way, he resembles, or was trying to resemble, I think he did it, a 19th century novelist like Thackeray. But he was also very attracted to genre fiction. He liked Jim Thompson. And in fact, Jim Thompson worked on Paths of Glory. Jim Thompson was the author of The Killer Inside Me, which is a first-person pulp fiction book about a homicidal, the guy's a murderer, right? And he's talking to you in first person, very frightening book. So Kubrick loved that one. It's hard to sort of identify him with a particular writer. In part, it's because Kubrick made movies that are so different one from the other. And yet, the movies are all tied together. I mean, the movies are in different genres. But you know, the more you think about the relation among the movies, the more insight you have into what he was up to as a director. So yeah, I'm not quite sure who I would compare him to most directly. He loved Kafka. He loved reading Kafka.
I could see that.
And yeah. And, you know, so there are various writers that you could mention as having some sort of affinity with him, or, you know, you could tell why he liked them. But yeah, nothing really springs out as the one that I'd compare him to.
I guess kind of what I'm getting at there is there are some obvious choices that among like writers, like you could pick Shakespeare and say, this person really described almost every nook and cranny of the human experience that a writer could describe. Do you think there's been anyone like that in film?
Mm. Well, that's a great question. I mean, actually, you know, the most obvious choice is, I mean, no one is like Shakespeare, but you could say, well, a director like Jean Renoir in The Rules of the Game, you know, shows us this spectrum of characters, and you know, they're all interacting in a country house, and you know, it's a comedy of manners, and it's a tragedy of manners. It's a film full of pathos and kind of delicate comedy. So Renoir really excels at showing the social fabric of a place and a time. And there are other directors like that. You know, he's not the only one. But, you know, I think most of the great film directors are in one sense or another somewhat narrow. And what I mean by that is, you know, you have Hitchcock, who has this kind of laser-like focus on the plot, on suspense. And there's a way in which he really sort of directs the viewer, you know, he's telling you how to react to the film. So I think that there's something in movies that really in a way argues against that kind of wideness, that incredible scope of representation that you have in a writer like Shakespeare or Tolstoy. And part of it is just the limits of the form, right? You have a couple of hours on screen. And I mean, we see this right now in the difference between films and TV shows, so that, you know, you can get much more of a spectrum of characters and social relations in a TV show, you know, like The Sopranos or Stiesel or whatever, the most remarkable television series. There are many of them in the last decades. Or so, two decades. Those are more like the realist novel than movies are, because movies only have a couple of hours.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, that's TV is really sort of, I mean, cementing itself as I don't know. There's kind of a reason why most of the the movies now are big Marvel superhero movies, and a lot of the art stuff comes on TV. But anyway, I want to let you go. David, thank you very much for talking to me. I really enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you, Duncan. This was great fun. And yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. So take care.
Is there anything you want to plug or let people know about before you go?
Not really. My book about Stanley Kubrick. That's it.
All right.
Okay. Great.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you to David Mikics, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.